counsel at the Kentucky Bankers Association, where he has worked in various roles for the past 6 years. Prior to the KBA, he worked as in-house counsel and in private practice, working in litigation and advised banks on a variety of issues. He is, like myself, a proud double graduate of the University of Kentucky Law School and undergrad. Go Big Blue. But I'm not here to talk to you about college athletics. I'm sure we could go on and on about that for a while. But I infamously on here picked Kentucky to go to the Final Four hours before we lost in the first round. So I'll steer away from basketball and we can talk about bank.
Yeah, we could probably talk about coaching searches, all kinds of things, the new hires. But, you know, that could go on for hours. But appreciate you having me.
Yeah, we're happy to have you on. So first, we always like to ask our guests, how did you get into law and I guess later banking and the compliance areas?
Yeah, so I always thought I wanted to be a trial lawyer and did that for a while in my career. But graduating law school, coming out in 2007, obviously challenged economic environment at that point in time, and found an opportunity with a boutique law firm in Louisville that specialized in banking, special assets, all types of different issues that were related to at that time, recaps, cease and desist, a lot of things related to the mortgage crisis. So a lot of times I say that I don't find banking law, but banking law found me back in 2007, but have loved working in it since then, and has been a great starting point for me back then to moving forward to a career in banking. So.
Gotcha. Well, it sounds like you're doing interesting work at the KBA now, where you're general counsel. I hear you've been working in DC off and on. Can you get into a little bit of that for us?
Yeah. So we, you know, at the KBA, we're very involved with advocacy on behalf of our banks, 170 member banks. But we're a voice in terms of what we like to do on the regulatory front. We write a number of comment letters, constantly meeting with the regulatory agencies and advisors related to that. But the realities are we're in a really difficult environment. We constantly get new regulation, whether it's by virtue of supervisory highlights, proposed rulemaking, or it can just be a one-page email that we get about video games from the CFPB in a day. So a myriad of issues that we're tackling, and I feel like it changes day to day, but doing our work in Washington and then really around the country, meeting with various regulators to talk about the issues and the challenges we're facing, and then really trying to figure out a way to push that up to Washington so that they understand the impact that's having on our banks. And some of the issues that we've been working on really recently, obviously fees is a huge topic. NSF, representment, overdraft, depending on the agency, you know, there's some different viewpoints. I think at least my opinion is if you're talking about CFPB, they would prefer to have zero fees. You talk to some of the other agencies, there's some different viewpoints that as long as you disclose, you're okay. But really kind of working on that dichotomy or multiple facets of how it's affecting different banks with different regulators and trying to keep our banks afloat in this really challenging environment and keeping them on track with the regulatory landscape as it continues to change.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, you know, in my role here at Compliance Alliance, working on Hotline, we're getting asked about junk fees almost every day. And there seems to be just a ton of confusion out there about, you know, what is a junk fee, what is not a junk fee. I mean, a lot of the guidance has been on representment fees, but maybe can you get into a little bit of some of the other primary fees that are being affected and which regulators are saying what? I know it's kind of a mess out there. Maybe this can help clear up the confusion.
Yeah, you know, I think at this point, if it was up to the CFPB, they'd probably say every fee is a junk fee. There is no real fee that's not junk. But when I talk to other prudential regulators like the FDIC, OCC, even the Fed, you know, they take a lot of these fees of and saying that as long as you disclose, generally speaking, you're okay. You know, obviously NSF, overdraft, representment are the primary three, but you can even see it somewhat on the lending side. Is that starting to hit? You see it with appraisals. It's starting to leak over. And I do have to give Director Schoper some credit in being a master marketer because, you know, 2 years ago, there was no such thing as a junk fee. And then as much as we hated the initial guidance coming out talking about junk fees, it's created this groundswell where junk fees is now a common term. It's not something we know. We now put in italics. It's something that's been adopted. You hear people in Congress talk about it as terms of junk fees. And it's now become nomenclature for us when it was really this shock and awe thing at the front part. We're fortunate enough to have a number of Congress people that are fighting against junk fees and against these actions of the CFPB and great groups. You know, we've got a lawsuit against the CFPB. I know Texas Bankers Association, American Bankers Association, others have multiple lawsuits. But it's amazing how much this thing has really shifted in the last 2 years. And I know you all, Compliance Alliance, do a lot of work with this, but it's just amazing to see this groundswell of this huge seismic shift related to fees in a short period of time.
Well, and again, I love your nomenclature comment because I can totally attest to that. I mean, when this first came out, I think we danced around calling them junk fees. It seemed kind of like a dirty word. We use quotation marks, and now when we get questions, I mean, everybody just uses the phrase junk fees.
Yeah, and it is amazing. And then, you know, what's really changed, I think, in these last 2 years was, you know, we saw this traditional rulemaking taking place of, you know, notice and comment period. And now all of that's essentially been circumvented, and you get things like supervisory highlights titled Supervisory Highlights Junk Fees Update Special Edition, issue 31, fall 2023 from the CFPB. And then from there, they're really telling you everything that happens in the landscape and what's right and what's wrong, and that essentially any fee is wrong. If you read through the 23 pages of that, it says, here's what we're seeing in the marketplace. The way to fix that was to get rid of the fee, and we're expecting everybody else to adopt it. And it's not just the bankers, it's the cores, it's everyone across the spectrum. I think it's a huge challenge for us. And I think my largest concern, and we just had met with regulators last Thursday, meet with them on a regular basis, meet with congressmen on a regular basis, but was talking to them last week, and I said, you know, the part that concerns me the most for financial institutions at this point is that the most important person in the bank is the compliance person. And I love my compliance people. We host roundtables every quarter. I talk to a lot of them daily. But that's not banking, and that's not serving communities. We're so concerned that regulation is the number one priority for banks. And that's across the spectrum. And we've tried to communicate that to various members of Congress, both on House and Senate. And I think we're getting some really large support there. And we've seen a number of bills filed in terms of regulatory oversight, you know, from Congressman Barr. We've seen some come from groups out of Tennessee and attacking on various levels. But, you know, I think the largest one you can see is just taking a look at what happened with 1071 and passing a joint resolution and a bipartisan joint resolution, which doesn't happen in Congress anymore, and come to an agreement, right, and ultimately get vetoed by the president. So, you know, it's a tough environment, and I really feel bad for our bankers, but I'm thankful that we have resources like you all to help through the process.
Well, yeah, and you guys at the KB are doing your work too. You know, going back to your comments about, I guess, notice and comment rulemaking and supervisory guidance, I mean, you're seeing the guidance in this issue kind of in this area all over the place. It might help if you could explain a little bit about the differences there, like, and what could happen after, you know, our election in November, if there's a change in administration, how, you know, notice and comment rulemaking could be affected versus, you know, supervisory guidance.
Sure. So, you know, I think one of the things that's been interesting and somewhat disappointing to see is that traditionally we would see things, new law happen through bills, right? They would go through Congress and we'd have something come out as that really meets theoretically the intent of the people. And since nothing's really being done in Congress in terms of this, partly because of the political divide, but on other issues, we've seen everything happen through agencies, and which, you know, traditionally, you know, going back to 10 years ago, we'd see notice and comment and rulemaking, but we've seen that really parsed down even in itself. So within notice and comment periods, you know, traditionally would be applicable to all. We've seen rules to address that, like SBRIFA, which essentially says that any small entity above $850,000, I think is the threshold on that, they have to go through some additional rulemaking type things. So to avoid the rulemaking, they're doing other rulemaking by saying, well, it's $10 billion and above, knowing that it's going to have a trickle down for every other institution. So we're seeing some avoidance of the rulemaking process because, quite frankly, if you don't have a rulemaking process, you don't have to have comments. You don't have to deal with stakeholders. You don't have to listen to bankers. So there's that part. And then we've seen, you know, what I like to call from a legal perspective, dicta, you know, just a one-liner of, like, for example, the CFPB last week saying we're coming after video games. I never thought I would see a prudential regulator coming after video games, but here we are reading something on that. And then, you know, really by exploring things out and expanding, right? So we've got Dodd-Frank, which contains 1071 and 8 data points. And Director Schober will argue with me whether that 8 data points is data fields or their points. To me, either which way, I think it's a major problem for our bankers. I think it's discriminatory towards those applying for loans. But then you see even larger expansions on that. After they make rulemaking, they come through with these highlights or dicta saying, here's what our expectations for the rule. And it's not formal rules, but this is how things are being enforced. And I don't know how bankers can expect to keep up with the daily onslaught of anything. And it can be a quote from a news conference, and that'll tell you where things are going. But it's coming in so quick and so fast that I think it's hard for bankers to keep up with. And you all probably see it on your side as well.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I mean, it's tough to keep up with. I mean, we're getting a lot of questions about just our regulatory change management track, where we're just keeping up with different regulations and guidances that come out and how they can keep theirs up to date. So banks are getting it in all directions right now. But I guess in all directions on that point, you know, we previously talked about some of the different things you've been talking about in D.C. I mean, we've already talked about the junk fee issue, but you also mentioned that you've been working on fraud issues. I didn't know.
Yeah, so we've been really excited and proud of some of the work that we've done in the fraud space over the last year. We started out our own fraud academy this last year, which we now have, I think, 27 states participating in. So one of the things that we did here at the KBA is we identified fraud as a big challenge for our industry. We know that we oftentimes, as bankers in our banks, are on the losing end of fraud, whether it's through Reg E or UCC check writing issues. You know, the banks are there oftentimes to bear the burden for consumers. And that's sort of the reality with it. But we thought we need to work together on fraud, because if it's hitting one bank, it's probably hitting others. We know we're not going to see a lot of change from the regulatory space on that. We're not going to see a lot of change from Congress on fraud. But we are working on really some large cohesive things. So we launched our Fraud Academy last year, in part with working with a lot number of the federal agencies, pretty much every alphabet letter you can think of in terms of on there. We're a little limited with disclosures on where they are, but they're basically all in there and telling us where things are hitting nationwide. It's had a tremendous impact in Kentucky. We've had several banks save several million dollars from things that they learned from the Fraud Academy in terms of warning signs, things like that. And then also in terms of collaboration. So we know that bad guys go up and down interstates and hit banks. They'll use the unhoused population to cash bad checks. Little things that you wouldn't think of. So I was talking to my dad this week, and we were talking about going into branches and the use of suckers. So you might not be aware of this. I was not aware of this before Fraud Academy, but you know, customers coming in, walking in with a sucker and grabbing a sucker is often a warning sign for fraud. We talked about a lot of that when working with law enforcement related to that, because a lot of times when they're using drugs and things of that, the sugar apparently is a big hitting point for them. So they'll grab multiple suckers and they've essentially trained the front lines to be aware of these type of situations. So we're really proud of the work that we've done with this. Looking forward to our expansion and taking it nationwide this August. But our banks are losing. And, you know, there are realities involved with all of banking and wholesale, that as we lose fees, you know, we're in a challenging environment in liquidity. Loans are difficult, and we're losing money on fraud. And particularly in the community bank space, I always question our prudential regulators, are you trying to keep banks in business, or are you trying to put them out of business? Because there are just some realities involved with this that if it goes along this continuum, we'll continue to lose more and more banks and have more banking deserts, which are a big problem for us in Kentucky, but I know around the country, not unique to us.
And are you seeing any trends in the different types of fraud? Are you seeing it predominantly in one area or another? I mean, I can tell you we're getting more and more questions about check fraud here at Compliance Alliance. What sort of trends are you saying?
Yeah, so check fraud seems to run pretty regularly. You know, that one seems to never stop. I think we get calls about that one daily, unfortunately. Obviously, there's the big issue with the Postal Service and the keys related to that. But the ones that we've been seeing lately are actually in more rural areas. People, you know, deposit their sent mail back into their own mailbox and put up the red flag. We've seen a lot of people over the last month that are driving down rural community roads. And if they see the red flag up, they're grabbing all the mail out. They're pulling a check. They're going and washing it. And on the payee line, so it might be written to John Doe, they'll write John Doe or Jane Doe and go deposit it at another institution. So it looks like a perfectly valid check. Add some zeros behind it, are able to work through it, and those hit. Another big one we've seen is real estate fraud. I know this is sort of a newer type of fraud, but seems to be hitting a lot more in the area. So they'll get a real agent to go and list typically vacant land, and they'll have contact with the agent, go visit it. Sometimes it's someone who deceased, property in the state, but everything will clear out on the title search, go to close. But what you never meet are the sellers. They'll never come and sign a document. They'll want to wire everything out. Generally only answer by phone, never come into a closing table. We've seen that hit well into seven figures here, up and down, particularly the I-65 corridor, which is a big area for us. But a big challenge there, and one that's been concerning and hard to catch. The other big one that seems to hit here is, and is also very persistent, is the romance scams. So obviously Valentine's Day are tough with that, anytime around a major holiday. But those, you know, we see people wire out their whole accounts, and it's hard to stop people on that. So we're really working on consumer education with this, and that if it sounds too good to be true, unfortunately, it probably is. And there's a number of different tools we can use to combat that and know whether it's a real profile and things. But it's all about consumer education, and we have to stop fraud at the front lines. And that's been our big push while we're working on the fraud.
Well, awesome. Well, it sounds like you guys are doing great work with the Fraud Academy and are really getting education out there for both our bankers and our consumers out there. Another area that you mentioned that you worked on that I like talking about as well is AI. I've written a few things about that. What sort of AI issues are you touching? Because it seems like AI could touch so many different areas of bank products and services.
Yeah, so we were just meeting with we had a director's college here this last Thursday and meeting with a number of prudential regulators related to this. And one of the issues that we brought up in the open session was AI. And if you read the consumer compliance supervisory highlights from the FDIC from March of this year, they talk about it very briefly towards the end about AI. And we've been heard from our banks for a good period of time that the regulators were starting to ask, what are your third party vendors using in terms of AI? And then if they identified that a vendor was using AI, how are they using the AI? What does that look like? And what are they doing to protect that? Whether it's from a fair lending perspective, whether it's from a UDAP perspective, whether it's just from a general discriminatory perspective. And what our banks were saying was, well, I had no idea how AI worked. And I think the big concern with this comes is that there are a number of great things, I think, that could come with AI. You can see some great third-party vendors that use it in a positive way, you know, predictive analysis for, you know, in the healthcare industry, things like that are great. I think the part that's concerning, at least for me, for banks, is the way that the guidance is drafted from the CFPB, FDIC, and others. Essentially, the onus lies completely on banks. So regardless of what the third party is doing, whether you know it or not, banks are going to be held responsible. So you could be in a long-term contract with a vendor, and you are not knowing that they're using AI. They may start using AI, not telling you. And then all of a sudden you find yourself in violation and responsible for the actions of a third party vendor. I think it would be really nice that if the four letter agency that's out there right now that's supposed to protect consumers would take some responsibility for AI with third party vendors and not place the onus solely on banks. But
they're busy.
They're busy with video games. Yeah. They're busy with all kinds of other things and sending out other things. And if banks, why not, right? Banks can just deal with the problems and wear it for everybody else. But I think the AI space offers a number of opportunities, but it's the challenges that concern me. And I don't think our banks are professional coders. They're not writing video games. They're not writing this software. Yeah. They're putting in solutions that are meant to help consumers. But conversely, you all know, just as I do, these contracts are often long-term and you can get tied into them. So at what point in time does those that are actually doing it held accountable? And that's my concern. But
gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an exciting space, but something everyone needs to keep their eye on. It's not going away, right?
You look at it from the core providers too. I mean, you can see where they have add-ons that are going to be in there. And there are a number of great core providers, but we know that those contracts can be extremely challenging, which was one of our questions to regulators is, if you find one of these pieces that are theoretically in violation of UDAP, what are you supposed to do if you're locked in for 2.5 more years of a contract? And you go to breach and you're going to get sued, are you going to tell them to quit using the AI? You're just going to cut the product out? These are real wholesale implications that I don't think have been really thought through for the agencies. And I think it's something that really needs to be taken in a more proactive approach in terms of the actual vendors. One of the things that we asked for was a master list. If these vendors are a problem, why can't we have a master list? I've yet to find a regulator that said, these vendors are a problem, but we're willing to share with you and let you know that these ones are. It's go and vent it yourself and find out, or go use a magic thing called Google and see what the reviews look like. But I don't think that's a very good predictive analysis of what causes risk. So a big area of concern for me, I know it's at the forefront of the industry, but I don't know how we leave the sole burden of everything on banks without at some point them having to correct. And that's my concern across the spectrum.
Yeah, that seems to be the case in so many different areas there. So many of our regulations and rules are just so consumer friendly that kind of leaves banks behind in the dust. So one last thing that you mentioned that you've been working on, DC, that I just wanted to touch on. I know we're kind of approaching the end of our time here, but it was trigger leads. I didn't know if you could provide just a real, for our listeners, a quick overview of trigger leads and what sort of issues you've been discussing.
Yeah, so trigger leads is a huge problem. I can tell you that we had a state bill that was up. It was very aggressive on trigger leads. In attacking him. But right before we went to go testify on behalf of the bill, I had a bank president call me and he said, Tim, I applied to refinance a farm on a Tuesday. By Friday, I had received 51 calls from different mortgage companies and everything else saying, we need you to apply for this credit. We can give you this interest rate that's super low. But oh, by the way, if you ask us where we're located, what our name is, what we're doing, we're going to get rude, angry, disrespectful, and everything else in the process. And I think it's causing some really large consumer confusion. And I do think this is one of the areas in Congress that does seem to be getting some positive traction. There are a number of different bills out there right now with some co-sponsors, but all of them essentially address kind of the same thing, which is that there needs to be put some limits on this and some real opt-outs in protecting consumers. When you go and apply for a mortgage, you shouldn't get 51 calls in 3 days from different bankers. They could confuse you and really lead you into something that you totally didn't intend to get into. It may be false and fraudulent in and of itself. We've seen consumers lose money from that and have it not be a real call. But I think there is, some real positive side from both sides of from both sides of Congress, House and Senate, and from both sides of the aisle in terms of their concerns related to this, and that where there are consumers being harmed and confused, they want to address it. I know there's a number of issues that are in Washington that are on really high level priority things, but I think this is one that's gaining more traction. I hope that more and more bipartisan support gets behind this because consumers are losing money, and our bankers should be able to bank their customers without concern from third parties coming in and confusing them with other terms or harassing them. And I know that part of the concern from agencies is that they say this is a competitive environment. And I don't think that's true when you're essentially receiving 51 calls in 3 days. that's not competition. That's confusion and misleading. So right. Hopefully we can put a stop to that. But that's certainly one of our regulatory priorities, is putting a stop to that at the federal level, because ultimately that's where it has to come from.
Gotcha. Well, that's certainly some encouraging news there. So, well, I think we've reached the end of our time, but as we close out, we always ask our guests if they have any piece of advice they'd like to share with our listeners. Could be anything.
You know, the one piece of advice I would have when it comes to all regulation and really all legislation is to be heard. Call your congressman, call your regulators, talk to them about the issues. We can go as lobbyists, whether it's in the state or in a federal level, and go talk about issues. But they really want to hear what you're doing in your communities. Your people that are in Congress are voted there for a reason. They want to hear from constituents. They want to hear how 1071 is affecting your bank. They want to hear about all these different issues that you're facing. Those voices matter. And you don't have to be a bank president and a CEO for your voice to matter. It's for everyone. And I would encourage everybody to be advocates of our industry and the things we're doing. And that means being proactive and making things because you're business. And I think that's probably my one piece for us, because we can really make change as a wholesale if we work together and talk about it.
Gotcha. Thank you for that. I could not agree more. For the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.